but even those men began to surrender. Berg, who was known to my men, had left his brothers and was shouting at the enemy to drop their shields and swords, and C. Trigger was calling the same encouragement. Some men leapt from the walls onto the outer ditches, but Sietrich of Dunholm, whose men had been on the far left of our shield wall during the failed assaults, had stayed outside the fort, and those defenders who tried to escape were either killed by the men of Dunholm, or else meekly gave up their weapons. I remember my father saying that nothing is certain in battle except death, which makes battle resemble life itself. "Be ready for surprises," my father had preached. "Be ready for the spear thrust that comes under the shield. Be ready for the axe blade that hooks over the shield's rim. Be ready for everything," he liked to say. "And you will still be surprised." I had been surprised by Berg's survival, by the unexpected help of the Snaelanders, and now I was surprised by the speed with which Skoll's vaunted army collapsed. The fighting died suddenly, as if men were exhausted by the slaughter. The killing fury of my men was sudden and vicious. But then they began to realize they had won, and that to go on killing was to risk being killed themselves. Skoll's men laid down their shields when they sensed the fury was past, and men from both sides greeted each other. Many of Sietrigger's warriors and a good few of mine were Norsemen, and, like Berg, were finding men among the enemy that they had known years or months in the past. I saw Vidar Leifsson embrace a bloodied enemy who, moments before, had been trying to kill him. Only Skoll, his sorcerer, and his closest household warriors were left, and most of those men, some of them wearing the grey cloak of the Ofjefnar, showed little desire to fight. They had lost, and they knew it. I knew Skoll himself would not give up, but the only remaining thing worth fighting for was to make Snorri's prophecy come true, that two kings must die. Skoll might have lost this day, but he could still retrieve some pride and make a reputation out of the disaster. And so he came to find us, and to kill us. Sietrigger had joined me at the center of the fort, where an open space made a wide square in front of the largest building, which I assumed had been the Roman commander's quarters. He grinned at me.
"How's the leg?"
"Stiffening."
"Your arm?"
"Numb." He turned and frowned as men started to shout. The sound grew louder, and it could only mean that Skoll was coming, and that to the Norse this was more than a contest, it was an entertainment. Finan led his men into the square and frowned when he heard the shouting.
"They're drunk," he said.
"Probably." Sietrigger watched the alley opposite us. More and more men were coming from its shadows to line the edges of the open space.
"He's coming for a fight, isn't he?"
"He is," I said.
"And you let me fight him," Finan insisted.
"No,"
Sietrigger said.
"Your shield arm, Lord King."
"A fight with a sword,"
Sietrigger interrupted him.
"Not a shield."
"Stiora," I said, and they both looked at me. "For my daughter's sake, he's mine."
"No, Lord,"
Finan said, and just then men parted on the far side of the square, and Skoll appeared with Snorri. The blind sorcerer was plucking at Skoll's arm, talking low and insistently. Skoll seemed to be listening, but then saw us, stopped, and put a hand over Snorri's mouth to silence him. He stared at us for a moment, and then, very slowly and very deliberately, he drew his great sword, Greyfang. The excited shouts died. Skoll, aware that every man watched him, stepped into the center of the square. He wore his great white fur cloak over unscarred mail. His helmet shone, ringed with the gold of the kingship he claimed and crested with a wolf's tail. He held Greyfang in his right hand,
and with his left he guided Snorri so that the two of them stood at the center of the circle of men. He looked at Sitrygge, then at me.
"Who do I give the sword to?"
he asked. We were all so surprised by the offer to surrender that, for a heartbeat, no one answered. Then I found my voice. "To King Sitrygge," I said, "of course."
"Lord King,"
Snorri said, pawing at Skald's arm.
"Lord King!"
The sorcerer's eye sockets were shadows.
"Quiet, my friend,"
Skald said, patting Snorri's shoulder. The sorcerer was shaking slightly. He wore long, grubby white robes. He had lost his wolf skull and seemed bereft without his small dog.
"All will be well,"
Skald told him, then looked at Sitrygge.
"I have one thing I must do before I give you the sword."
"One thing?" Sitrygge asked, puzzled.
"Just one,"
Skull said, and with that he took one pace away from Snorri, turned quickly, and struck with Greyfang. Snorri had no warning. One moment he stood, frightened, then Skull's blade slashed across his throat with sudden savagery. Skull kept the sword moving, driving it and pulling it back to saw Snorri's gullet, and he opened the sorcerer's neck to the spine. Snorri's long white hair and plaited beard turned red. He made no noise, he just fell, crumpled, a mess of blood, hair and robes. An astonished gasp went up from the men watching. For a moment Snorri's body twitched as his blood soaked into the earth, and then he was still.
"He failed,"
Skull said.
"What use is a sorcerer who fails?"
"Give me your sword," Sitrygge said coldly. Skull, who seemed to be the calmest man in Hebra, nodded.
"Of course,"
he said. He took Greyfang into his left hand, holding her by the blade just beneath the hilt, and walked towards Sitrygge. And I could see the treachery. He was right-handed, yet he held the sword with his left, leaving the hilt free and his right hand empty. A drop of blood fell from Greyfang's tip as he walked towards us. He was smiling.
"You won,"
he said to Sitrygge, who took one pace forward to accept his enemy's sword. And Skald snatched the hilt with his right hand and swept Greyfang in a mighty backhanded slash that should have broken Sitrygge's one good arm, except that the instant I saw Skull's hand take Greyfang's hilt, I stepped forward and shoved Sitrygge hard so that he fell to his left, and I kept moving so that my borrowed shield crashed into Skull and drove him back so forcefully that he tripped. And suddenly both he and Sitrygge were on the ground. And I drew Serpent Breath, her long blade hissing as she came from the scabbard's throat. "He's mine!" I shouted, because both my son and Finan had started forward, and Sitrygge, recovering from his surprise, was climbing to his feet. I stepped forward, ignoring the pain in my left leg, and I kicked Skull's booted foot. "You're mine," I said.
"Stupid old man,"
he snarled. He was still on the ground, but tried to swing Greyfang at me, but only hammered her into my shield's iron rim.
"You want to die here?"
he asked. "You will die here," I said, and stepped away from him, letting him stand. And I remember thinking that maybe Skull was right, that this was stupid. I had dozens of young, sword-skilled warriors who were faster and maybe stronger. Finan was old, too, but he was still one of the most feared fighters in Britain. But I was Uhtred of Bebbanburg, and I had reputation, and the vanity of reputation made me want to kill Skoll. And I would kill him, for Stiora's sake, for my daughter,
and the memory of her face gave me an anger that overcame the stupidity. It was a cold anger, underlaid with fear. Skoll was formidable, and as he scrambled to his feet, with the blood-stained Greyfang in his hand, he looked confident.
"Keep your shield, old man," he sneered.
He had no shield. I let mine hang at my side, exposing my body, and stepped backwards away from him, as if I feared him. I exaggerated my limp. My mail coat was torn, and the bloody bandage around my left thigh showed, and I wanted Skoll to see it. I kept serpent breath low.
"Your daughter screamed when she died," Skoll said.
He was circling to his right, my left. "I hear your son drools now," I said. I had heard no news of the son whose skull I had broken, but it seemed I touched a raw place in Skoll, because he looked furious for a heartbeat, and took 3 quick paces towards me. I did not move, reckoning his steps were a feint, and he went back again, but still moving to my left. I turned, deliberately wincing when my weight was back on my left leg. My vision on that side was still blurred, but it was clearing.
"Can your son speak?" I asked. "Or does he just make noises like a pig farting?"
Skoll said nothing, but I could see my words were hurting him. I could also see him trying to calm himself, trying to plan an attack that would devastate me. "Can your son control his bowels?" I asked. "Or does he spew shit like a drunken goat?"
"Bastard,"
was all he said. And he sprang at me, sword swinging from my left, and I simply stood and let the shield hang on my left, and serpent breath on my right. And because his swing had been aimed at my left leg and my shield now protected it, the blow was wasted. Greyfang crashed hard against the shield's iron boss, but did no damage. The blow had been struck in anger, which made it futile, and Skoll knew it. He tried to disengage the sword from my shield by stepping backwards, but I moved with him, then fainted myself by bringing serpent breath up, and he twisted away from the threat, going back fast. And I laughed at him.
"When are you going to begin to fight?" I asked.
Men at the edges of the square echoed my laughter, and that mockery galled Skoll, who came at me fast and angry, again swinging from my left. And the years of sword practice took control of me so that I did not need to think, but just parried with my shield or else with serpent breath as he hacked again and again. I did not try to counterattack, but just defended, trying to judge his skill. I fought with a sword every day, matching myself against the best of my warriors, and Skoll, although he was fast and he was strong, was not nearly as fine a swordsman as Finan or Berg. He stepped back after 6 or 7 massive blows.
"Was that your best?" I asked him.
"You're a coward," he spat, "who fights with a shield against a man who has none."
"You told me to keep it," I said, "but I don't need it."
I let go of the hand grip, so that the heavy shield fell from my arm onto the ground.
"Is that better?"
Instead of answering, he attacked again. And again on my left, though both blows were easy enough to parry. Then he attempted a lunge quick and low, which I only just avoided by stepping to my right. Greyfang's blade slid by my waist. I heard it scrape on my mail's rings, and he jerked the blade up as if to sever my left arm, but there was not enough force in his outstretched arm, and my mail stopped his blade. I turned away from the blow and stepped a pace back.
"If you want the shield," I said, "pick it up. It's yours."
He took 2 paces back. He was breathing hard, watching me from beneath the gold-edged rim of his helmet. I had been judging his skill, and he had been judging mine, though he must have realized that I had not yet made 1 offensive stroke. The watching men had begun to cheer as we fought, and they were cheering me. Even some of the men who had been fighting for Skoll were joining those cheers. He was feared, not loved, and his terrifying sorcery was dead, and Skoll himself would soon be dead, He knew it. Even if he killed me, his life would not be spared. The best he could hope for was a quick death and a reputation as the man who overcame Uhtred of Bebbanburg. We were 4 or 5 paces apart as Skoll caught his breath. His attacks had driven me close to the southern side of the open space, so I walked back to the square's centre, again exaggerating my limp. He followed me, eyes narrowed, both hands on Greyfang's hilt, and I saw him glance at my leg. The watching crowd had fallen silent, but one man, an Orfjethin, judging by his grey cloak, called out for Skoll to kill me.
"Slaughter the bastard, lord!" he shouted.
"Lord King,"
Skoll corrected him, and my men began jeering.
"Lord King!" they shouted mockingly. "Lord King!"
And I took one pace forward, lifting serpent breath, and Skoll came for me. He roared a great challenge, a wolf howl of defiance, and he put all his strength into a swinging cut that should have struck my left side, and I watched his eyes, saw them glance at my waist, and I guessed the massive swing was a feint, and suddenly, with a quickness I had not seen in him before, he turned the sword in his hands so it was not coming in a wild hacking cut, but was a lunge to my right, that would force me onto my weak left leg if I wanted to avoid it, and it did force me onto my left leg, but I had seen the feint. My leg was not as weak as Skoll believed, and I lunged in turn. Skoll's lunge missed. Mine pierced his mail at his bottom rib. I felt serpent breath break the links of his armour, felt her burst through the leather beneath, felt her grate on and then break the bone, and then I twisted her as she went deeper. And Skoll's face was already grimacing. He was trying to wrench his body away from the pain, and I kept serpent breath twisting and turning, ripping flesh and bone, and then I barged him with my right shoulder and he went down. I let go of Serpent Breath, and let her fall with him. Skoll tried to bring Greyfang back in a cut, but I stepped on his right arm, then stamped my left foot on his face. He was shuddering, and Serpent Breath, still buried in his body, quivered. "Greet the Norns," I told him, "and give them my thanks." And then I tugged Serpent Breath free, and Skoll whimpered in pain, shuddered, and blood welled up through the rent in his mail. I held the sword's bloody tip at Skoll's throat.
"Lord King,"
I called to Seatrigger.
"Lord Uhtred."
"You want to kill the bastard who killed your wife?"
I heard Seatrigger draw his sword. Skoll was staring up at me, weakening. His eyes widened as Seatrigger lifted his blade.
"Wait,"
I told Seatrigger, then leaned down and prized Greyfang out of Skoll's grasp. I threw it towards Finan.
"That," I said, "is for my daughter."
"No,"
Skoll cried.
"Please, no! Give me my sword!"
And Seatrigger struck. And so Skoll went to Niflheim, where he is a feast for the corpse ripper. Steora was avenged. I think of my daughter every day. I watched her children grow, and wept that she would not see them become a man and a woman. I tell them of their mother, and sometimes tears still glint in my eyes when I speak of her. The waves roll on Bebbanburg's long beach, and the wind comes across the wild waters, and I know she is somewhere in the afterlife. Not in Niflheim, nor in the Christian heaven, but somewhere. Jeremias tells me there is a blessed place for good pagans, a vale of soft grass and clear streams.
"She's happy there, Lord,"
he tells me. And I try to tell myself that he is not mad and that he speaks the truth. He goes nowhere without his small white dog, that he calls Scarioth.
"Like Judas, Lord, who betrayed his master."
I have added Skoll's flint skull and Snorri's wolf skull to the masonry niches in Bebbanburg's skull gate. The skulls gaze blindly southwards to where Northumbria's enemies will gather. The Norse still live in Cumberland, but have sworn oaths to Sidrugge. He is king of all Northumbria. But Egil Skalla Grimason, whom I have come to treasure as a companion, tells me the Norse cannot be trusted. "Can I trust you, then?" I asked him.
"Of course not."
"But I do."
"That, Lord, is because you are a fool. But I am a poet, and poets love fools."
I gave Egil and his brother good land north of Bebbanburg. They gave me their oaths because, Egil said, I had saved the life of his youngest brother.
"We shall keep our oaths, Lord,"
he promised me as we rode home from Heber.
"Not that I care about Berg, of course. He's so ugly."
I had laughed. Berg was a good-looking boy, while Egil was extraordinarily ugly. Yet women seemed attracted to him like flies to blood. And soon there will be babies born in Bebbanburg, with ears like batwings and chins like ship prows. And still the waves roll in, and the wind blows, and one day, I know, a horseman will ride up the coast road, and he will bring me news from far away, of the death of a king, and of an oath to be kept. Weird Bith Full Arad. That was War of the Wolf by Bernard Cornwell. Read by Matt Bates. Text copyright Bernard Cornwell, 2018. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Bernard Cornwell asserts the moral right to be identified as the author of this work. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.